This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Antonio Hardy was a young and creative one, creative with a guy with a lot of things to say, in fact, when he encountered the perfect artistic outlet for him. Rap music was in its infancy when he was coming of age in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. By the time he was a teenager, Antonio was on his way to joining the ranks of the genre's best MCs. He adopted the moniker Big Daddy Kane and quickly made a name for himself as one of the city's best battle rappers. And in the late 1980s, his recording career had taken off with hits like Ain't No Half Steppin'.
Rappers steppin' to me, they wanna get some, but I'm the Kane, so yo, you know the outcome. I'm not the victory, they can't get with me, so pick a BC day cause you are history. I'm the authentic poet to get lyrical, for you to beat me, it's gonna take a miracle. And steppin' to me, yo, that's a wrong move. So what you want, Hobbs? Dope a dog food. Competition, I just devour.
The ingredients of Big Daddy Kane's success were rap skills, style, and sex appeal, a combination that has earned him iconic status in the world of hip-hop. The Brooklyn-born rapper now makes his home in North Carolina. This weekend, he's going to perform at the 42nd Annual Bimbe Festival in downtown Durham. But right now, Big Daddy Kane is my guest on The State of Things. So great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, man. Glad to be here.
You grew up in the birthplace of hip-hop. What do you remember about rap music when it was getting started and you were just sort of paying attention to it on the streets?
Well, I mean, it was just something, you know, that was so different. Like seeing brothers, you know, get on the mic and rhyme at block parties and things like that, house parties, and like to actually hear it go national, you know, like the first time you heard a actual song, you know, on the radio. I mean, it was just amazing, you know.
Because this was stuff that you were just listening to, and it was competitive. When you thought about it, apparently the idea is you want to be the best. Not in the world, not in America, but on the block.
Well, you know, at that point in time, it was something really like constructive for the youth in the hood, you know, something that could, you know, have you stray away from the gang violence and all that, you know, because you can now you can be competitive with one another in a battle, you know, battling this person who's the best rapper, who's the best DJ, who's the best human beatbox or break dancer, you know, as opposed to a contact sport, you know.
And how were they structured? Where were these contests? Where did they happen?
Oh, well, a rap battle could happen in the bathroom in school, you know, in the lunchroom, you know, on the street corner with the rapping thing, DJing, you know, naturally that would normally be at a park jam. Or sometimes if it's real personal, you know, you may end up in someone's house, you know, where their turntables at, you know, in their house, you know.
You had a cousin who was a rapper who you idolized. Tell us about him.
Oh, I had an older cousin named Murdoch. Like when I was young, probably about 13, you know, he was person that I really looked up to, and once he started getting into the rap thing and started doing it, I would thought it was real slick the way he did it because he used to play the beats on his hands and be rapping, and I just thought it was real slick. So I tried to get into it because, you know, he was doing it, but he was rhyming with two other guys. So what I was thinking was, well, I'm gonna start and I'm gonna try to write some battle rhymes that I can battle them with, because if I beat, you know, the other two dudes, then he'll put me down.
So you were in competition at least with your cousin or with the two guys?
With the other two guys. Yeah. I felt like if I beat them, then my cousin will let me be down.
And then you finally decided to take a shot at rhyming yourself. This was when you decided to go into competition and see if he would take you in, right? As part of his group.
Well, yeah. I you know, basically asked his the guys that was down with him, you know, to battle me so that, you know, he could see that I was better than them and put me down with his group.
And then in the mid-1980s, you met Philo, a hip-hop pioneer, Biz Markie in Brooklyn. He already had a name by then, right?
Yeah, Biz had like a street name. You know, he was known at a lot of parties and you know, events. You know, his picture had been on a few flyers. So he had a lot of street credibility in the hip hop world. And you know, we met, we battled, and afterwards, you know, he was like telling me, and you know, I think that you know you're great, and we should get together. I do a lot of shows here and there, and we could make a little bit of money.
The story I heard, too, it sounds like, you know, sort of these great Western, the fastest gun in the West. You were actually seeking him out so you could do a battle again to kind of make your name and work one way up. You know?
Well, yeah, what it was a friend of mine, a gentleman by the name of Wayne. I never forget. You know, he used to always come to me and tell me, I heard Biz rhyming, and he said such and such. I heard Biz doing the human beatbox. I used to get tired of him always telling me about Biz, so this particular time, he was right across the street. So I said, well, let's go in the mall, introduce me to him, and I'm going to battle him. And after the date, I want you to go to Biz and tell him about me. you know.
And you did. And then eventually you started collaborating and on some of the songs in Biz's album, and you wrote lyrics for him on a number of hits like this song, Vapors, 1988. Let's listen.
I got another partner that's calm and plain. He goes by the name of the Big Daddy Kane. The mellow type of fellow that's laid back. Back in the days, he was nothing like that. I remember when he used to fight every day. What grown-ups would tell him, he would never obey. He wore pants hanging down and his sneakers untied. And a Rasta-type tangle tilted to the side. Around his neighborhood, people treated him bad. He said he was the worst thing his mom's ever had. He said he would grow up to be nothing but a hoodlum. Or either in jail, or someone would shoot him. But now he's grown up to their surprise. Big Daddy got a hit record selling worldwide. Now the same people that didn't like him as a job, saying, can I borrow a dollar? Ooh, you're a star now, they call the baby.
Biz Markie, The Vapors, written by my guest, Big Daddy Kane. What's it like to write yourself into Biz Markie's songs? That's pretty cool.
Oh, I wasn't getting left out.
Yeah. Well, what about the storyline in that, that you were kind of a troublemaker before you made it big? Is that,
I don't think I was a troublemaker. You know, I think I was your average kid, you know, that wanted to explore, see different things. Mm. You know, that's all.
So you talked about working with – and then my question, too, is what's it like being a ghostwriter, writing for? I mean, if the trick is to win the battle and kind of work your reputation up, is that a whole different role when you start writing music or lyrics for another artist?
Well, I'm someone that always thought of myself as an artist, someone who loves to paint a picture. And because of what I do and what I'm known for – it's for that, you know, fast, rapid flow style of rhyming. But that's not all I do. I do have a sense of humor. I do, I love, you know, telling stories. So with artists like Biz, you know, and other people, I had an outlet to basically showcase some of my other talents, you know, like other forms of writing, you know, rather than what I'm basically known for. So it's fun, you know, it's basically like acting, getting into another character.
How important, though, is in your own career, is the storytelling part of rap?
I think storytelling is very important, you know, because number one, you want people to listen. And if you have something to say that's, you know, getting the attention, then they're going to listen. You know, if you're just saying a bunch of nonsense and it's all over the place, then they're probably just channeling to the beat and be satisfied with just that, you know.
So you build a career and a reputation out of these style points, as you say. There's the fast rap style. You can make them come out pretty quick. You stick with the beat, but then storytelling and the story that you have to tell is important. Was it the same story? Were you trying to tell the story of your life? How political was it? How personal do you think your stories are?
I believe that my stories at sometimes, you know, became personal. Sometimes I spoke about you know, some of my experiences. Sometimes I spoke of other people's experiences, you know, tough times I've seen someone else go through, stuff that's happening in the world, you know, or even, you know, just funny stuff that I've seen in my life.
What about ghostwriting? We talked about writing for Biz Markie. Did you write for other artists as well?
Oh, yeah. I've written for other artists, you know, Roxanne Shanté, Curtis Blow, Positive K, Rick James, yeah.
When you do that, do you have to pay attention? Do you have to think deliberately about their style, or do you write something, put it out there, and say who wants it? How does that work?
Well, at that point in time, you know, it was basically someone coming to you asking you to write something for me. Right. You know, because, you know, in the origin of hip hop, it was basically against the law for someone else to write for you. It wasn't like, you know, singing, where that's a common thing.
Right.
In hip hop, like that, basically was against the law. They found out you didn't write your rhymes; that you were called a whack MC or a sucker MC. Those were the terms they used, you know. For
so you weren't covering. Nobody did covers of anybody else's stuff. That was certainly off.
No, that didn't happen back then.
So what happened? Why did things change when an artist felt like they could come to you and ask you to write for them?
I don't know. I
mean, business got big is probably what happened.
No, I mean, I think it was more or less like maybe certain artists felt like I could basically capture them.
Yeah.
You know, I could tell, you know, I can help them tell this story the way they want to tell it.
Was that a different kind of writing for you than when you wrote for yourself?
I mean, honestly, it wasn't different. It was stuff that I had already done, you know. Yeah. Just, you know, I just never really released it for myself. You know, like, you know, a bunch of silly and, you know, funny stuff or, you know, things like that. I never, you know, really done it for myself because, you know, that wasn't the image I was trying to project, you know, or the sassy stuff yeah. that I may have written for, like, Roxanne Shanté, you know.
Where did the name come from, Big Daddy Kane?
The name? The Kane part, you know, it came from my fascination of martial art films back in the days. You know, I was just always a big kung fu buff. And at that point in time, two basic names everybody knew was Bruce Lee or Kane, Young Grasshopper, you know. So that's where the Kane part came from.
On the State of Things today, we are talking with hip-hop artist Big Daddy Kane. Just ahead, we're going to talk a little bit about Kane's signature songs, some of his well-known artistic collaborations as well. That happens on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, hip-hop artist Big Daddy Kane, going to perform Saturday in Durham, the 42nd Annual Bembe Festival. Kane, your first single, Raw, has been called one of the greatest rap records of all time. Let's listen to it.
R-A-W, a terrorist, here to bring trouble to phony MCs. I move on and seize, I just conquer and solve another rapper with ease. Cause I'm at my apex, another bar below, nothing but a milliliter. I'm a kilo, second to none, making MCs run, so don't try to step to me, cause I ain't the one. I believe rappers just like Tylenol, and they know it, so I don't see why you all try to front, perpetrating a stunt, when you know that I smoke you up like a blunt. I'm genuine like Gucci, raw like sushi, this age of rage is what rap did to me, to make me want to create chaos and mayhem, cold rock a party. Until the AM, I'll make a muscle, grab the mic and hustle. While you stand dazed and amazed, I'll bust a little rhyme with authority, superiority, and captivate the whole crowd's majority. The rhymes I use definitely amuse, better than Dynasty or Hill Street Blues. I'm sure to score.
Big Daddy Kane, Raw. Big Daddy Kane's my guest this hour. You rhyme with Tylenol. Congratulations.
I'm sitting there tripping on like how you can date yourself in music. You know, I said, you know, muse like Dynasty and Hill Street Blues. Mm-hmm. Like, that's when you're showing your age, you know, for real.
How much of that holds up? It's certainly of its time in a lot of ways, and it will take you back to 1988 when you did that. But how much of that do you think holds up and is an essential part of what hip-hop was in the beginning, is now, and ever will be?
When you say holds up, you're referring to what, the music?
In that music, in that particular song. Do you think it's particular? Is it just a period piece? Does it only belong to 1988 or are there elements of it that we still hear today in other people's music?
I guess from the music standpoint, no. From the lyrical standpoint, yes, you have a lot of young artists Corey Guns, Joel Ortiz, Saigon. You know, these are a lot of young upcoming rappers that I hear a lot of, you know, that flavor, you know, in their styles.
What was it in that song, do you think, at the time that made people think this is the best record that's ever been put out?
Probably, well, you know, like the beat was very hard, but also the rapid fire style of rhyming, you know, because at that point in time, you know, it was where either when you rhymed hard, it was basically yelling, mm-hmm. like pretty much the styles that Run DMC and LL had, like basically yelling the rhymes out, or you rhymed, you know, laid back, which was like the styles of like a Rakim, KRS, well, not KRS-One, EPMD, you know, but with this, it was like rapid fire, fast rhyming, you know, so it had that hard edge, but it was still, you know, a little more laid back and, you know, being articulate, trying to make sure that everyone can hear every single word.
Was that a very deliberate idea on your part? This was how you were going to make your mark, or you just found yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to make sure you heard what I said. Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms of the rapid fire, too, the making it real fast, was that?
Yeah. That was, you know, well, no, honestly, with that, it was the type of thing where that was just my way of writing. you know, crowding a bunch of words into a sentence.
So you had to figure out how to get them out. And so now I've written this thing. Now I've got to get it out. And I want it to be articulate. People have to understand what I'm saying.
Exactly.
This also goes back, the idea that you weren't going to be content just shouting to get an edge. Probably, can I guess, goes back to your love of rhythm and blues. You loved the old soul records and that whole generation that preceded you.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. You know, before the rap thing became popular, as a child, I would wait till my father go to work. And then I would go into his closet, raid his closet, put one of his suits on, and just stand in the mirror trying to sing a Marvin Gaye song. Like, this was my thing. So when I actually had the opportunity, you know, to perform and become an artist, I started trying to basically adapt that Marvin Gaye type of swagger, when I did my thing.
You are known for using samples of that soul music as well in the 60s and 70s. In the 70s, "Long Live Kane," I think, is a song that exemplifies that. The song starts with a sample of James Brown. It "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud," right? And then right at the top, you also hear a sample from the funk band The Meters in that song. Let's listen.
Party people in the place, embrace the bass as I commence to pick up the pace and make it motivate and accelerate. Cause like Tony the Tiger, I'm great. Always seem to come off hard for you somehow. I mean, me being whack, oh come now. That's quite ridiculous. So just admit you was thrilled. Cause on your face, it is conspicuous. Not that you're on this, but my performance is rather exquisite. So what is it but supremacy? That's the perfect definition. But rappers keep wishing to be in my position. No good and damn well, there ain't no competition. I gotta give it to you, kid, that's ambition. For you to perpetrate the role of me, the big daddy, the big father, nah, don't even bother. Cause that would mean you would have to teach each and every one idiotic son trying to make it. You can't fake it. The rhymes out of sight are fully dressed and yours are butt naked. Your speech is weak while mine stands strong. So all hell, the man is here to live long.
What was it like for you to finally find yourself in an industry and a style of music that welcomed this kind of sampling so that you could do both, channel your love for R&B and soul and move into the next generation?
Well, you know, at the time, you know, it was beautiful, you know, because I guess, you know, songs that, you know, you really enjoyed, the break parts that you really enjoyed, you were basically making your own. Because, you know, at a block party, they throw a certain beat on that everybody's crazy about. The mic line might be 15, 20 people waiting to rhyme off that beat. The DJ switched the beat. Now you're sitting there mad, talking about, yo, throw that back, throw such back on. Yeah. You know, so now you had the opportunity to make it your own. But, it was a time period also where we weren't really aware of the wrong that we were doing, you know, because at that time, you know, a lot of stuff weren't cleared. So it's basically stealing someone else's music. You know, we were kids. We didn't know what we were doing, you know.
It is an interesting concept. On the one hand, yeah, this is somebody else's property. We've got rules about that. You just talked about it. On the other hand, the improvisation, the idea that you could take something else and then turn it into your own is a fascinating and I think still an innovative and creative idea. The question is, how do you do it and still play by the rules? Were you surprised? And you did. And ultimately, everybody figured that out too, I think.
Yeah, you just have to pay.
Yeah, that's easy.
Yeah.
Were you surprised? We talked about this being competitive. The idea was to get a name on the street, not necessarily a national name and not even for the big bucks. Were you surprised that this became an industry and you could actually make a very good living at this kind of thing? It's not just about reputation on the street.
Well, yeah, I was surprised, you know, definitely that, you know, that I could make you know, a living, you know, doing it. Because, I mean, I really got into this really just to be recognized as the best rapper. It wasn't about money, you know. But, I mean, to see how lucrative it can be, yeah, I mean, I was like, you know, wow, this is cool. It's something beautiful. But as far as rapping a whole, I always thought that this would escalate and become something real big and major, you know.
On your second album, you had the opportunity to collaborate with New Jack producer Ted Riley on the song "I Get the Job Done." And I want to play the intro of that song right now.
Yeah, fellas. Okay, now it's time for y'all to hold on to your ladies because the next performer is a real smooth operator. He's been compared to Marvin Gaye, Casanova, and Iceberg Slim. Right about now, my man is so hot, he's on fire. So just watch, listen, and you'll see. Brooklyn's own Big Daddy Kane. Wow, Kane.
Right about now on the MIC, I be the B-I-G-D-A-W-D-Y-K-A-N-E, the smooth operator, none greater, the Big Daddy Kane. In the place to be, I got my dancer, Scoop Lover, and Scrap Lover. On the wheels of steel, DJ Mr. C. Can't forget my man Minister and Air Live, and Cliff Love as we set it off like this.
Baby.
The question at hand is how do I love thee? I count the ways, but girls, don't shove me. One by one, you can come and caress me. Undress and molest me, but you can't possess me. Because I love a young lady that's beautiful, but one that's smart for me is more suitable. In other words, to make it simple and plain, you gotta have a brain in order to be Miss Kane. But in the case of not becoming my lady, I take them 8 to 80, dumb, crippled, and crazy. Crisp and clean with no caffeine and a pair of spandex or either tight jeans. Preferably the ones with the Chinese cut, but I take them with the weave hanging down to their butts. And if you step up in a large sum, like Martin Luther King, I should overcome. I get the job done. Ladies and gentlemen, Scoob and Scrap Lover.
Big Daddy Kane, I get the job done, as we heard in that introduction. Sex appeal was a big part of your persona on the stage, and I think something you cultivated that played a big part in your success, right?
Oh, absolutely. It definitely did. You know, you had artists such as myself, LL Cool J, you know, Houdini, you know, who basically, you know, sold sex appeal with their music, you know.
You talked about, too, when you were a young man and you would sneak in and listen to your father's Marvin Gaye records and also put on his shirts. He was a good dresser. You're a good dresser. You put on some fancy clothes on stage.
Yeah. You know, with no disrespect to the B-boys, you know, it's when you talk about hip hop, from in a cultural sense, the B-boy style of dressing is always what, you know, came along with it. But, you know, that necessarily wasn't my thing.
That's sort of a street look.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the street look. Right. It's just that, you know, I've just always been that type that, you know, like from watching, you know, all the R&B performers and everything, I was always just the type that felt like, you know, you want to look slick on stage. And the last thing you want is to be on stage performing and someone in the crowd got on the same thing you wearing, you know?
Well, it's interesting to say that about R&B and about hip hop. We think of all these genres as very narrow, very iconic driven, so that everybody's got a style, you got to stick to that style, that's how it works. But what you're suggesting here is it's a much bigger tent. There's a lot more variety, and if you're good at what you do and you understand what your persona is, people are very tolerant and, in fact, very accepting of what you offer.
Absolutely, because, I mean, you never know how you can touch someone, you know, how you affect someone's life, you know, you never know.
You started your career as part of the Juice Crew Collective. They were signed to Cold Children Records. What's that like being part of a collective like that? I mean, describe how that worked.
You know, it was a type of thing where, you know, we were all together and everybody was, I guess, basically trying to have their own identity. You know, Biz was like basically the comedian of the group. I was the battle rapper. MC Shan was the crazy one. Cool G Rap was the gangster rapper. You know, that type of thing.
Got it all going on stage. Your sense of style, a very important part. And we talked about, again, you know, your dad's sense of style. Where did that come? Your dad was he drove a truck?
Yeah, he was a truck driver, yeah.
But he had a sense of style, I guess, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's where you got all the fancy shirts and things.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I used to see my father, you know, put on like 4 or 5 piece suits, you know? Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, the pants, the vest, the blazer, and the duster, you know? Yeah.
When you put this group together, too, at one point you were working with dancers Scoob and Scrap.
Yes.
Tell us about them and how they fit into your whole act.
Well, as we were trying to basically assemble a real tight stage show, as a fan of James Brown as well, what he did with the Flames, you know, I remember, like, you know, how they would, you know, join in together on the break and, you know, things like that. So I was like, this is something that I want to do. So I found two dancers, you know, one who I knew for a long time. And we, you know, came together and basically started, you know, rocking together and, you know, doing the routines where they're dancing throughout the whole song. But on the break, I would join in with them and, you know, do the routine with them.
As your career grew and you got bigger and bigger audiences, did you get any kind of professional help for how to put a stage act together? Or was this all your own intuition?
Honestly, in the beginning, I used to hang out with with Dougie Fresh a lot. And, you know, he would sit down with me and tell me all these, you know, crazy stories and show me, I'm about to show my age again, show me on Betamax tapes of like Pink Floyd, Michael Jackson, Earth, Wind & Fire, and like explain like ideas that they did on stage that he transformed into hip hop. And I was like, okay. So what I did was I went home and found like the people that I like. So I, you know, got footage of Marvin Gaye, Barry White, and I took, you know, stuff that they did and transformed it into hip hop.
Give us an example of that kind of transformation.
Like, for example, like when I do Smooth Operator, I think pretty much anybody that's been a Kane fan, it's like they know that along with the beginning of the song, they're waiting for me to do the Marvin Gaye dance with my hands up in the air and I'm doing a little wiggle. They know that that's basically part of the song now, you know. Like Barry Swagger, a way he had of slowing it down, speeding it up, slowing it down, speeding it up. I adapted that, you know, as well, you know, just so I could, you know, maintain my energy and, you know, keep my voice.
How much of that is a deliberate reference? In other words, people are watching knowing that that's a Marvin Gaye move and that you've picked it up and done something with it on your own. That's one thing to say, I know that's a move, but a generation later, we might not know. We say that's a Kane move. How much of it is you saying, no, this is the way I want to be on stage? And in other words, how important is it that the audience knows it's a reference to an earlier artist?
I mean, I think it's more important to me. You know, it's more important to me, you know, that I know that who I'm paying homage to, you know.
You've had an opportunity to work with a number of top-notch producers, Marley Marl, you've got Ted Riley, Quincy Jones, all people you've worked with in your career. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with the artist, the relationship between the artist and the producer.
Well, you know, the producer's job is basically to, you know, give you that right song that fits you as an artist. You know, I feel like Marley Marl, you know, always knew how to do that. But, you know, we started together. Teddy Riley, I mean, I remember our discussion, you know, when we first, you know, worked together. I explained to him, I'm like, look, I don't really like the stuff that you did for Heavy D or Mo D, so don't give me that. Give me what you give Guy, which is the group he was from. Mm. So when he did get the job done, it had like the feel of a track that the group Guy would use, you know. And I mean, I felt like, you know, he basically gave me what I needed. Quincy, something totally different. I mean, I never seen nothing like that before, you know. I mean, when he knew that I wasn't aware of Ella Fitzgerald history, or Miles Davis history, like he sent his assistant to bring like the whole Black Encyclopedia to the studio, and he sat and told me stories about what he seen Miles Davis do on places where Dizzy Gillespie did something real spectacular. He called Ella Fitzgerald and had me rhyme on the phone to her, and I can comparing my fast style of rap with her style of scatting, you know. Yeah.
How did that change you as an artist?
I mean, I'm in a room with Quincy Jones, and he's putting me on the phone with Ella Fitzgerald.
That's pretty amazing all by itself. And you take your style and you talk with her, then you realize there's a history. That, did you suddenly feel part of something much larger? Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, it's like with what I was doing in hip-hop, like I said, I wanted to be recognized as the best rapper. Okay, but now I'm a celebrity, and now I want to be accepted in the music genre. You know, I want what I'm doing to be, you know, accepted and respected. And with people like Quincy Jones doing what he did, Barry White, Patti LaBelle, you know, doing songs with me, I felt accepted, you know. Like people, you know, didn't just look at me as... like, they didn't just look at me as the rapper that was hot that moment, but they respected my talent.
Big Daddy Kane is my guest this hour on The State of Things coming up. Kane talks about forthcoming studio project, and our conversation will continue on The State of Things after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Big Daddy Kane. The Brooklyn-born rapper now makes his home in North Carolina. This Saturday, he's going to take the stage at the annual Bembe Festival in Durham. Right now, he's with me in the studio. You talked about working with other R&B artists like Patti LaBelle, for instance. Let's take a listen.
And deep in your mind, there's pure satisfaction from the need of true companionship. And once you feel it inside your soul, oh man, you get captivated, elevated, jubilated, fascinated. So many feelings, it's hard for me to state it. Cause no one can really define the power of love and the stopping the sense of taking over. And you know, but comfort of one another, lover to lover. No matter how you avoid it, it's still gonna uncover. When you can't detect it or reflect it, don't try to neglect it, you gotta respect it.
Yeah, Big Daddy Kane and Patti LaBelle, so you feel like you are respected now in that big, wide world of music.
I mean, you know, I'm cool, man. You know, I'm cool. I mean, life is beautiful. I've been blessed to do what I've been doing for, you know, the past 23 years. So, I'm, you know, everything is fine, man. I'm real happy.
Still feel that connection to R&B?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You are perhaps best known for your those battle rap skills, your charisma, and your persona, but you have also addressed social issues as well, never been afraid to address those.
I say the mother, as in the motherland, but on the other hand, another man tackled and shackled our ancestors, but we beat them with freedom. So let's bless the country that we all came from, because the moral of it all is we shall overcome. The cream will keep rising, we be sizing up. The Asiatic one is enterprising, building and building to carry on, all the way from Malcolm X to Farrakhan. Martin Luther was a tutor, many were pupils. Those who fell victim were those without scruples. However, to sever, we could never. So hold up the peace sign and stand together. Take heed to the words that I manifest. So when I'm through speaking, Marley Marla do the rest.
Do you feel that your work is political? Do you feel that politics is important to your art?
No, I don't feel that politics are important to my art. I feel like they're important to me. So therefore, that's a part of me, and I'm going to tell you what I feel. You know, I mean, you know, there's certain things that's going on in the world that, you know, a young hip-hop fan may not hear on the radio because he doesn't listen to the news or whatever. So, I mean, I would definitely, I mean, certain things I feel like the youth need to be aware of, you know. So if I can, I would definitely try to express it to them, you know.
So you do, you feel a certain responsibility then as an artist to play that role?
Yeah, me, yeah.
You personally. Since you moved to North Carolina, you've been involved in a cause to combat gang violence. You worked with another hip-hop pioneer who lives in this region now, Christopher Play Martin, on a documentary called Welcome to Durham. Tell us about that.
It was something that my road manager now asked me to be involved in. And I got together with a great producer from the North Carolina area, Knife Wonder, and Little Brother, and we did a song together speaking on the gang violence here in Durham, you know.
Yeah. What is the scene here? And you talked about Ninth, and of course he was with Little Brother, who was part of the group. He was part of Little Brother for a long time, a group that got started here. What's the hip-hop scene like in this area? Is it strong, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think that basically in any area, you're going to have a strong hip-hop scene because, you know, as far as music goes, it's pretty much just as strong as pop right now. You know, they kind of coincide to a degree, you know. So, you know, you're always going to have a strong hip-hop scene. Here, you know, it's very strong, you know. It's not as diverse as it used to be, but it's definitely strong.
You've collaborated in the studio with Ninth Wonder. You talked about him. And more recently, you recorded with Rapsody of the hip-hop group Coolie High. Let's listen.
Yeah, rough, rugged, raw, you're on standstill. Seal Navy, you know flow lately, greatly resemble the seas, specifically innately. I was born gifted, they rate me Hades, hot,
for never not, I never stop, cleverly jock quite a bit as I rock with the
I
king's
still get
spit.
Ill and kill it, will and build and drill the skill, the thrill, the feel, know what the deal. Microphones, I hold on that Texas poker, the one the chick's stressing over, let me show you the strength of this weapon. You asking for the remix just to get in the session. Well, the track is night wonder, we the 10th and 11th. Let me make it simple and pleasant. Speaking the word is lethal when heard, and trust me, this ain't
peaches and herbs, yeah. Young black with a gift, rap bill with the god, Big Daddy in here, yeah.
We drop heat on them and keep the street on them. Rats D and BDK got a lead on them. We don't feed on them, we just breathe on them.
The game ain't ready for this.
Listen, we drop heat on them and keep the street on them. Rats D and BDK got a lead on them.
Young black with a gift, rap bill with the god, Big Daddy in here. Yeah.
Put up the homage signs, baby, because we all here working. Sure.
So there you are, working with Rhapsody. It's an homage to you and the other greats in the business, but also this is a young and up-and-coming artist. What's it like to be in the studio with somebody who's actually idolized you?
Rhapsody is an incredible young lady with a lot of energy and a lot of ambition. The reason why I told Ninth Wonder I would love to work with her because I saw her at a concert here at Cat's Cradle performing with a lot of his other artists. And I just, like, really, truly felt her energy. I was like, she's talented. I really think she has a bright future. Yeah, I'd love to do something with her.
A second ago, you talked about diversity, a kind of maybe a lack of diversity in the sound. What do you mean by that?
I think that, you know, right now, a lot of the rappers, you know, that's out right now, they're basically going one direction. You know, they're basically following the trendy pop direction, you know. And, you know, it kind of scares me in a way for the simple fact that I've watched hip-hop grow and I want to see it continue growing, you know. But I don't really feel like there's enough room for growth right now once you fall into a trendy thing, because trends come and go. Yeah. So when that trend is gone, you're gone.
So what would revive or revitalize the music, do you think? What does it take?
I think that artists really have to start being artists again. Or better yet, let me rephrase that. Rappers need to start being artists again. You know, once you really understand how to be an artist, what you're doing now is you're making it where you're bigger than your music. You don't put an album out this year or next year, you still have a strong fan base that's waiting for your next move. You have people that are buying a certain kind of sneaker or a certain shirt because that's what you wear. You know, they're supporting a certain cause because you support it and you've embedded in their head so strong that they believe in it as well, you know.
So is that a function of success, the industry itself? I mean, you got into this industry and it wasn't much of a business. And as we've said it a couple times now, you just wanted a little street cred. You want people to notice you. That's not what the business is. Kids must come to this now wanting to be big stars, right? And that's different. And that may be a different approach and aesthetic.
Wanting to be big stars, sometimes that need to be a big star can be the dangerous step you take because you, now that you want to be a big star, basically you're going to do whatever it takes to be a big star, which might mean selling out or falling into something real trendy that only works for that moment.
Is there anything on the scene anywhere in this country or elsewhere that you hear as the next new thing, the really artistic vein that's taking off somewhere?
Well, honestly, what I really, really enjoy right now are artists like Amy Winehouse, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. I love this new direction that Raphael Sadiq is taking. I'm waiting to hear more from The Roots. I think that right now you have a lot of artists that's going back to soul music. And not only are they going back to soul music, they're going back to live instruments.
You are working on a forthcoming studio project that incorporates all of that, soul sound of the 60s and 70s. You're recording with a live band called Connie Price and the Keystones. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, a band that I toured with several times doing tours for Scion Motors. We decided to get together and work on a project. And along with an R&B vocalist who sings with rap artist Pharoah March, we all came together and created a project called The Last Supper, where we're basically merging vintage soul with vintage hip hop. You know, the 60s and 70s sounding soul with 80s sounding hip hop. You know, just creating a merger there with the two to create like a new alternative form of music.
And live is an important part of this to you. Why?
Oh, live is important to me because what we do on stage is even more amazing. Oh, with the band, it's like the stuff that I've done just to track, I've taken to a whole nother level on stage.
Did the music get, or has it gotten a little too studio centric? In other words, all the devices, the production techniques become the sound itself, and we lose sight of the performance side of it.
It happens sometimes. It does happen sometimes. I mean, I guess, you know, basically what it is like how many, like all the new technology has became so simple that anyone can be a producer because the technology is doing the work for you.
Right. Well, we have a studio recording. We talked about Connie Price and the Keystones, that project that you're working on. We do have some studio recording. It's still a work in progress, but we did find this audio clip of a live performance. Let's listen.
Let's get this here party started right. Here we go, y'all. Check it out. Let it roll, get bold. I just can't hold back the phone because I'm the man with soul. And control and effects of what the heck. Rock the discotheque. This groove is what's next. Attack the guy. I'm going to move to it. I'm going to throw the floor with the groove to it. I keep the guy live in your height. Do damage on stage and into the mic. Because I shoot the gift from six, stand still. Run my rhyme, stick, trick it like skipping and jerking. Feel my blood fizz on my death. Kiss the rap solo. So let's all sing the Big Daddy anthem. Follow the flow, my rhymes flow like an afro. I entertain the game and never have no problem. Actually, stumble and fall. Even if I stutter, I'ma still come up. The rappers can't understand the mics I've hit. Sure enough, ain't equipped. That's why they got flipped. And my apparatus is up to status. Don't add to the baddest.
Connie Price and the Keystones with Big Daddy Kane, my guest this hour on The State of Things. So much of the music, especially in a live performance like that, it's obvious how much energy you're drawing from the crowd. In the earliest days of hip-hop, it was new, it was fresh, people are responding, and the music is growing leaps and bounds. Are we also a victim of that? Expectations have slowed down. It's become an industry. We're playing the same kind of thing over and over. People are not expecting enough.
So you got to understand, back in the 80s when hip-hop was first basically being introduced to radio and to record companies, it was something new. So therefore, your A&R or president of black music at your record label, they were really just fresh off of working a Gap Band song or a Stephanie Mills record. And you're bringing them something they've never heard before. They don't know where to place it or what to do with it, you know. So they're just taking a shot, seeing what happens when they give it to the radio station. Yeah. You know, this is something they're not accustomed to playing. So as long as it's not cursing, degrading women, okay, we'll give it a shot. We'll try it. You know, it's something new. But now we're in a time period where you have a lot of young cats that's working at labels, young cats that's at the radio stations. So therefore, they're basically dictating the pace, saying, nah, that's not hot. We need something that sounds like this. We need it to sound like that. I'm not going to play it unless it sounds like this. I'm not going to sign you unless you sound like him. Yeah. And then what happens is everybody starts sounding the same. There's no originality. There's no diversity. There's nothing. Everything starts sounding the same. It sounds like one long song.
Now, with Connie Price and the Keystones, it sounds like you're bringing together two different forms, but it is stuff that we've heard before. Is it new, or are we going to be hearing covers of old sounds?
Well, we did cover two songs on the album. We covered Millie Jackson, Child of God, and we covered the Guess Who, These Eyes. But we changed it. Instead of these eyes, we're saying these lies. You know, one verse is talking about, you know, lies that, you know, the government tell to the people. The second verse is talking about marital issues, you know, like lies that, you know, couples tell to one another when they're cheating, you know.
So now you're living in North Carolina. Big transition for you from Brooklyn and your life on the road. Do you travel much?
Oh yeah, we are always on the road. Yeah. I'm in South Carolina. When is it Friday? And then, of course, I'm here Saturday, and then you know next week we have Rochester and the Bronx. You know, I travel a lot. that's pretty much the only thing about, you know, this that I really, really love. You know, I love performing, you know. I still love, like with a serious passion. That's something I still enjoy with a serious passion.
What brought you to North Carolina?
I used to come down here back in the days and, you know, just to hang out. And I used to, you know, always say, like, you know, it's kind of remind me of Long Island a little bit, you know.
Wait, this kind of reminds you of Long Island a little bit?
Yeah. You've been to Long Island?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are parts of Long Island, I guess. It's just there's more traffic there, I guess. A little less traffic here.
Yeah, I mean, the laid back feel, you know, I dig that. Yeah.
Well, Bembe's coming up. That's a big festival, and it's been going strong here in Durham for a long time.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. You know, sharing the stage with my man Rob Bass, and I'm, you know, really looking forward to it and entertaining, you know, the people here in North Carolina. You know, hoping everybody from Durham, Raleigh, Cary, Chapel Hill, wherever,
and come the greater Apex Metroplex. I made that whole thing up. Great to have you on the show, Big Daddy Kane. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Big Daddy Kane's going to perform this Saturday at the annual Bembe Festival downtown Durham. Takes the stage tomorrow at 6:30 at the CBC Plaza. For more information, visit durhamnc.gov or officialbigdaddykane.com. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. You can find us at our website, stateofthings.org. Follow us on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.